My name is David Noreen. I'm interviewing today Robert Green on October 1st, 2007 in Studio X, Campbell Hall, Urbana, Illinois. Henry M. Radcliffe will be assisting on lights, camera, and audio, and we'll be talking about Mr. Green's service in the U.S. Navy. Okay, Mr. Green, welcome to Studio X. Could you please tell us your story?
Well, begin at the beginning. I grew up in Los Angeles after moving from Boston at the age 4. We arrived in Los Angeles in 1923 when things were rather primitive out there, as you know. We lived on the west side of the city, not in beautiful West Los Angeles, what they call West Los Angeles and Brentwood, but in the Middle West. Actually only a couple miles from the Culver City boundary line where the studios of MGM and Hal Roach and all those movie people were. A very middle-class neighborhood. I attended Hamilton High School in West Los Angeles and then on to Los Angeles Junior College and 1 year at UCLA, which was in 1939. My junior year in college was at UCLA. At the end of that year, which was June of 1940, government, the Navy and the Army both started special midshipman schools. We didn't quite know what that was all about. The war in Europe had already started, so we knew that there was going to be some kind of involvement. And the Army and the Navy were very foresighted in signing up young college men. We had to have at least 2 years of school, college at that time. And so I signed up for the Navy Reserve Midshipman School, not exactly knowing what was going to happen. And the recruiter, this was June, and I needed my senior year to start in September. Oh, he said, that's okay, you'll be able to come back to school. Well, as you know, things didn't work out that way. I received a letter to report to the New York Midshipman School. Well, actually, for first we had to go to a 30-day training aboard a ship. And so that was in October of 1940. And following the trip, the cruise, 30-day cruise with no pay, we were assigned a midshipman school to attend in the future. And so I was assigned to the New York Midshipman School starting in March of 1941. That was a 90-day or 3-month or 90-day school. And as I say, all the fellows were either college graduates already or had at least 2 years of schooling. And so we went through the 90 days, and we were called 90-day wonders because we got our ensign stripe after only 3 months of schooling. Of course, it's different from the regular academies, where the fellows are going to college anyway, and we were already had all our academic work. We had we were history majors and mathematics majors and engineering majors, and so it was like we'd already been to college, which we had. So after the graduation ceremonies, we were either allowed to go home for a short time or assigned directly to ships. And quite a few of my classmates were assigned to Pearl Harbor right away, or to the Navy training station at San Diego or San Francisco. I went home for a month or so and got orders ultimately to report to Seattle. First I had to report to San Francisco for another 6 weeks of schooling. Mm-hmm. So I went to San Francisco in maybe September of 1941 and attended the 6 weeks of additional schooling for transport ships, cargo ships and transport ships. At that time, by fortunate, I happened to meet the young lady that became my wife a short time later. It was in October of 1941, and I met her in a restaurant in San Francisco because of the UCLA Stanford football game. She was a co-ed at UCLA and was up there with her girlfriend and waiting for a ride. Her cousin was going to take them down to the football game. And so I bummed a ride with her. And 18 months later, we were married. Mm-hmm. So you never know what's going to happen when you pick up a strange girl somewhere.
So you met her before the war, but then you got married.
Yes, that's right. We met before the war, and in a couple days after I met her, which was early in October, I was assigned to this ship in Seattle, which was being reconditioned. It was a President liner from the Pacific Fleet, and the Navy had bought up a half a dozen of these passenger ships and was converting them to troop transports. And so that's what was going on in Seattle. And three others of my classmates from San Francisco and I were assigned to the USS Zeilen, which was then being refitted and converted in Seattle at the shipyard right at the foot of the city. So that was October, November, December. We were lying there in Seattle waiting for the ship to be finished. And finally in January it was ready to go, and we took off and made our a lot of Pacific Coast cruise up and down the coast to get the ship ready for the war.
Do you remember what you were doing on December 7th, 1941?
December 7th, 1941. Yes, I remember very well. I was still in bed on Sunday morning, and I was listening to the New York Symphony broadcast. They had every Sunday during the winters, the New York Philharmonic broadcast on NBC the concert, which I suppose started at 2 o'clock in New York, which was 11 o'clock West Coast time. And I was listening to the radio and the symphony when they broke into the broadcast and said that Pearl Harbor had been attacked. So the other guys and I put on our uniforms very quickly and went down to the ship, which was still a dead ship. It was not ready to sail anywhere, but we were required to report for duty, such as it was, and we didn't have anything to do really. So that was December 7th, and of course after that time, Seattle was in danger. They felt they were in danger all the time of an enemy attack. And so the city was blacked out, and we just continued our normal life. And finally in January, as I say, we were ready to take our ocean tests and get ready. We had to go down to San Diego to get our boats. You know, this ship had 32 personnel boats. They were called Higgins boats sometimes, or other kind of designation, personnel. Also, four larger boats, which carried a large truck or a small tank, and they were called a tank lighter. That's the one that had a great big ramp in front. The original Higgins boat did not have any ramp. The soldiers or Marines would come in over the side of the boat and leave on the side of the boat into the water or jump over the bow of the boat. So anyway, we had to pick up our boats in San Diego and get the boat crews trained. So that went on for a couple of months while the damage at Pearl Harbor was being cleaned up. And ultimately, we had an assignment, and we took the first contingent of troops to the American Samoa. This was in, I think it was in April of 1942. Attack on Tokyo had taken place only a couple of weeks earlier in March. What was the name of that? You remember the air attack on Tokyo, 90 minutes over Tokyo, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So we took this contingent of troops to fortify Samoa, and we were at the harbor at the Pango Pango for 30 days. They wouldn't let us come home because there were so many different things pending. At the same, just at about that time, the Battle of the Coral Sea was taking place, where our forces of the Yorktown and Lexington aircraft carriers had defeated the Japanese and prevented them from landing in Australia at Port Moresby. So we were there in the harbor at Pango Pango for 30 days while the troops were all ashore. And so ultimately we came home back to San Diego, and the Navy was preparing then for the invasion of Guadalcanal. We didn't know what that was all about, but we picked up our contingent of Marines. We had, our ship could carry approximately 1,600 Marines or soldiers at one time.
This was the Xylon, the refitted ship.
Pardon me?
This is the Xylon, the refitted
ship?
Yeah, the Xylon.
Uh-huh. And so we were assigned to the operation, which included the attack on Guadalcanal, but two ships, mine and another ship, were assigned to the island of Tulagi, which is across the bay from the main landing place at Guadalcanal. So we took 1,500 of the 2nd Marine Division to Guadalcanal, to Tulagi, which they captured in a few days. But meanwhile, we the night of our landings was a very terrible night. Japanese came, warships came down from the north. They called that the slot, body of water between the islands of the Solomon Islands formed a channel, and they would come down from Rabaul, which was their main base, and they attacked our escorts and decimated our fleet there. They sank about four or five cruisers and damaged four others, and sank four or five destroyers. That was a midnight battle, which had us all up in arms. We were all on deck waiting to be attacked. We didn't know what the heck to do.
And what was your role on the ship? What kind of duties?
My role on the ship at that time, I was called a boat officer and division officer. The deck divisions were in charge of putting the boats in the water and taking them back out. And then I and three or four other ensigns at that time were the boat officers. We would have the boat, take the boats into the beach for unloading or soldiers or unloading cargo. So there would be five or six boats in each group, and each ensign would be a boat officer for the group.
I see.
So that's what we were doing, except at night, a lot of the boats were loaded with ammo and food for the troops on the shore, but we had to jettison all that baggage and bring the boats aboard because we had to get underway because we didn't know if the Japanese warships were coming for us. Fortunately, before dawn, we found out that they broke off and went back home. But even so, the Navy command didn't want the transports to stay there and risk being sunk. So we had to leave the soldiers and Marines on the shore more or less without additional weapons, ammo, and food. But that was only a few days' time, and they got supplied again. So we went back to the New Hebrides Islands, and we had a lot of work to do between the New Hebrides and New Caledonia, where we went a couple times. In between, we took a boatload of Japanese prisoners. They were Korean laborers who had been taken prisoner on Guadalcanal. And so we took them down to New Zealand, I guess for, I hate to call it R&R, but they had these Japanese prisoners in New Zealand. Never did know what they ever did with them down there. So we were in New Zealand for a few days and then came back and did some more work. It was kind of like Mr. Roberts, you know, with going from apathy to tedium or someplace. We were doing a lot of that kind of cargo handling.
So the Japanese had taken Korean prisoners and then forced them into slave labor.
Yes. Yeah, that's about
the size. They kind of abandoned those prisoners.
Yeah, that's about the size of it. The prisoners, the Korean laborers, were the only ones who ever surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had no weapons, they couldn't fight. As we know, the Japanese soldiers and Marines never did surrender. They had to be...
fought to the death.
Yeah. In October, we made another foray into Guadalcanal with another boatload of troops, shipload of troops, excuse me, for supply and reinforcement. And that night, there was a terrible battle called the Battle of Santa Cruz, where the Japanese again came down just after we had departed the area, and there was another terrible battle ensued where more of our ships were sunk, including maybe the next night. Okay, I'll defray that one. On November 11th of 1942. We made our final resupply trip to Guadalcanal, taking more soldiers and more supplies. And that time, enemy planes came over and dropped some bombs right next to our ship. I was in the water. I was in the boat at the time, along with the... maybe 100 other sailors and officers. And we watched from the boats. We could see the planes attacking our ship. And our captain was able to evade most of the damage. But a couple of bombs came right down and exploded outside of our hull. at the stern of the ship and flooded the stern with water, we were very close to being sunk at that time. But they got the ship underway, the damage was repaired, and we hauled the boats aboard, and we left the area, going back to safe harbor somewhere, and finally back to Pearl Harbor and back to San Diego.
Did you have any anti-aircraft guns, or not because it was a refitted cruise ship? Were there ships with you that were able to fire at the planes?
Our own repair crews fixed up our ship primarily in order to get us out of the area and back to New Hebrides, where further work could be done, and finally back to Pearl Harbor and then back to San Diego.
But were you able to defend yourself against the planes?
No,
you didn't have.
We had 50 caliber machine guns around the ship, but they were not of any use at that time because they were high altitude bombers. Yeah,
right.
They weren't dive bombing us, but they're just. The ship was all but defenseless, really. That night, November 11th, there was another terrible battle called the Battle of Tsavo Island. And that, I believe that's the night that the five Sullivan brothers' ship, the Juno, was lost or sunk. So.
And it was after that point that the policy was changed that brothers wouldn't all serve on the same.
Yeah, that's right. So my ship was kind of lucky in a way, although we were damaged at that time, both in November and December. October and November, we escaped just before a fierce naval battle had broken out. And otherwise, had we been in the harbors there, we probably would have been lost in one of those battles. So the damage to our ship was such that, as I say, we had to come back to Long Beach and go in the dry dock for 3 months, at which time they refurbished the ship completely and gave us new armament, a large-scale 20-millimeter machine guns for the deck all around the ship. And at that time, I had this, I was still in touch with my dear girlfriend, the one I met in San Francisco, Betty. And being in Los Angeles area for 3 months, we decided to get married.
Mm-hmm.
I always told her she shouldn't marry a sailor from the Pacific that's going back to war. But we did get married in February 13th of 1943. And we're still together 64 and a half years later here in Champaign, Illinois. Let's see, what else do we want to know? Our ship was finally repaired in around March of 43, and we were assigned a very pleasant interlude of duty to film the movie of Guadalcanal Diary. The Richard Tregaskis, the author, had written this book just after the battles of Guadalcanal. Guadalcanal was secured for fighting purposes as of January of 43. And he wrote this book about the Marines. And so the movie crew would come down to San Diego and board our ship in the morning, and we would go out in the all day in the San Diego area, out of sight of land and other islands, and pretend that this was the invasion force for Guadalcanal. And we had all the movie actors aboard and the director. and a couple of guys who were dressed in general's uniforms who the sailors didn't know who was real and who was not. Mm-hmm. So our sailors and my roommate, for example, were starring extras in this movie.
And they were later able to see themselves on the screen when the movie came out?
As many of them could, especially my roommate, Anson Kern, who was on the top deck with his binoculars and his hat, with a name across there, Kern, a lawyer from New Orleans. William Bendix and Lloyd Nolan and Richard Conte and the other movie stars were aboard our ship for 5 days. Mm-hmm. We would take them back to San Diego in the evening and then pick them up the next morning again. So that's what we did for 5 or 6 days. And finally, at the end of that period, the studio had constructed a beach landing scene at the Marine Base in Southern California there, Camp Pendleton. Mm-hmm. And so we loaded the movie people into our boats along with real Marines. And we ran them to the shore just like a real operation. Mm-hmm. And they all jumped out and went through the trees back to Never Never Land. So that was our time in Hollywood. After that, we got ready to recapture the Aleutian Islands. And in May of 1943, we boarded the 7th Army Division in San Francisco, and 5 or 6 transports were involved with the battleship Pennsylvania and quite a few destroyer escorts. And we made the long trip over to Attu Island in the Aleutians. And by this time, I had been promoted. I was no longer a boat officer, but I was assistant beachmaster. Now, for every landing operation, there has to be a beach party. It's not the kind of beach party with girls and beer. It's a beach landing party where you control the boats from your ship that are coming into the beaches. And we would go in about the third wave. The first wave of soldiers would leave their boats and go ashore. So we were about the third wave, and we would come in. There were probably about 30 to 40 men altogether. My boss, a lieutenant officer, was the beachmaster, and I was assistant. And we had one doctor. Oh, the doctor, by the way, on the beach party was my best man at my wedding.
Oh, okay.
And he was a Chicago doctor who was a heart and internal specialist. And he retired to La Jolla, and we're in touch all the time still. He's somewhat older than I am, but he's still with it. And we get together whenever I go back to Southern California, and I talk to him on the phone every once in a while. He's a nice guy. So he was our best man, and he was our doctor on 6 or 7 landings. He made more than I did. So we had a doctor and half a dozen what they call pharmacist mates, are the Navy equivalent of medics. Mm-hmm. So we had the medics ashore, and we'd have a couple of radio men, a couple of signalmen, and 8 or 10 regular sailors to do more heavy work. So whatever we had to do ashore to keep the boats coming and going, that's what we did. And we lived ashore there for 5 days on the sand that Attu, which was an absolutely terrible place.
The Japanese had seized that, people have wondered, was this a diversionary thing? Or
the Attu?
Yes.
Not, for us?
Well, I think, aren't there different theories about why the Japanese had seized it?
Oh,
are they trying
know.
To divert us from the South Pacific, or possibilities of attacking Alaska, or
well,
having a base there?
There was a I guess they took Attu and Kiska at that early on in order to have a guard duty on the northern perimeter. And it would have been helpful if they had been able to capture Midway. But I don't know any other devious reason for that. But we felt we had to take it back because we couldn't have we couldn't have them on our territory, so to speak, and making flights over Midway or over the Western Pacific.
So they were using it as an air base?
Yeah, it was an air, they had an air base there. So anyway, that after the Army took about 30 or 40 days to secure the island, I don't know how many troops, how many Japanese there were there, but it was that was a very bad place. Continuous fog, rain, even though it was May of the springtime, it's always terrible up there. And so we came back and fooled around San Diego again a little while, and then the Army decided to mount another invasion, and that would be Kiska. Kiska lies a couple hundred miles east of Attu. So we mounted another invasion, and again, I was an assistant beachmaster. And maybe you heard about Kiska. When we got there, a day or two later, we learned that there were no troops. There were no Japanese there. They had left under the cover of fog a week or more earlier. And ultimately, the story came out many years later that our high command actually had known that there were no Japanese in Kiska, on Kiska, which was a nasty thing. It was really terrible. We had about 30,000 men that we landed there. We had 10 transports, I think, all kinds of destroyers and a battleship, Canadian troops, and everybody, you know, it was a terrible thing because a landing operation is never an easy thing. There's
always the possibility of fatalities just from always having to coordinate everything.
That's right, exactly, and especially in that kind of weather, it was so bad, you know, fog and rain all the time.
Why do you think that that they went ahead with that? Do you think it was a matter of not wanting the Japanese to know that we had broken the code, or
no? In one of my stories, they asked the commander, well, he said, maybe there's no Japs there, but it'll be a good operation. It's good
practice.
Well, you know, with 30,000 men, you just don't casually have a good practice landing. It's pretty high. And I don't know if you know this. 20 soldiers did die. They came across each other in the fog, and they didn't know that there was no Japanese. Somebody opened fire, and there was a whole fusillade of fire, and 20 people died. And so, that's pretty awful for a non-existing enemy. What amounts to a practice landing is just unconscionable. Mm-hmm. So that's the way that was. Following Kiska, what happened? That was August of 1943, and we came back to San Diego again.
Now, were there other Aleutian Islands as well, or was just those two that were...
Those were the only two that the Japanese had occupied.
Okay.
The islands themselves stretch all the way from the Alaskan mainland to 2,000 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Cold Bay and Dutch Harbor and all those places. All lovely scenic spots to go to.
Was it ever determined where they had gone to? Was there a ship that they had been able to, you know, get to and return to Japan?
I'm sorry, I don't understand.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, when you got to the island, there were no Japanese there, that they had gotten away in the fog.
Oh, yeah.
But had they just gone back to Japan?
Oh, yeah. Most likely, yeah. They had submarines and transports that just took them back to Japan, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So after we got back home again, then we had another operation, and that was our... my last one on this island, we went to New Zealand, where the 2nd Marine Division had been having R&R after the Guadalcanal campaign and other operations that they had been in, and we picked up 1,500 Marines. We were along with maybe 10 other transports and several cargo ships, and we made the invasion and the recapture of Tarawa in the Central Pacific. And again, I was assistant beachmaster at Tarawa with the same crew, the same 30 or 40 guys, and the same doctor, Dr. Hasterlick, and his corpsman. And as you know, or you may know, Tarawa was a pretty dreadful operation for the Marines, and not so great for the Navy either. That operation essentially lasted 4 days, and 1,100 Marines died, mostly in the first day, or half of the second day. 2,400 more were wounded, and some very severely. The landing was pretty terrible because there was no place to land. The island is surrounded by a coral reef, and our boats couldn't get ashore over the reef, and the Marines had to debark and walk through the water, shoulder high water sometimes, all the way to the beach, and they died.
They were under fire the whole time, right?
Mm-hmm.
They were under fire from
And
the
they
beach.
Were under fire from the shore, oh yes, under fire all the time. And the boats were being blown out of the water too. They brought in these things called Amtraks, amphibious tractors, which could float and run at the same time, you know. And they were supposed to be able to crawl over the reef, which they could do for the most part, but they were so slow that after they got into the lagoon, the Japanese gunners ashore could see them and blew them out of the water. So we lost almost all those. I don't think any Amtrak ever got back to its base, to its base ship. So the Marines struggled ashore, and meanwhile, we had two boats for the beach party, and we never could land the first day at all. And we were in our boat all night long, just going back and forth, because you couldn't stand still, otherwise they might gun you. So in the morning, this Tarawa had one feature. From the island, there was a long pier, which was a supply pier and seaplane ramp. So this long pier went from the land out to the edge of the reef, and that's how they got their supplies in. And so my beach party was instructed to land at 8 o'clock the next morning on the end of the pier, and we set up there to bring in boats. The pier was wide enough so that two boats could come in at the same time. And they brought troops and ammunition and armament. Some of the, we could get field pieces in there, and a tank, and then more tanks and more mortars and so forth. So ultimately, all morning long, we were bringing new stuff in. And meanwhile, the Japanese defenders were all around the perimeter of the island facing us. And my lieutenant, boss, had the bright idea of building a wall. And so we built a wall of supply boxes, like ammo boxes and food boxes. We built a wall along the pier for about 30 yards. This pier was like, it must have been about 200 yards long, maybe 300 yards maybe, like a football field.
Two or three football fields.
Yeah. And so we built a protective wall at the end of the pier to keep us from being hit by sniper fire. And so we worked all hunkered down. The Marine corpsmen would bring their wounded boys out to the pier, and we would, our doctors and corpsmen would fix them up for, do what they could, and we put them in the boats and take them back to the ship for hospitalization. Mm-hmm. My ship, the Zylon, was also a Class B hospital ship, and we had a sick bay that could accommodate about 25 or 30 people. But when we kept bringing the wounded guys back, and they would lift them up on the stretchers from the ship. By the time we got through with the operation, we had about 300 wounded people aboard. And the other transports and cargo ships the same. We had a lot of guys. There were, as I say, there were at least 1,200 wounded Marines during the 3 or 4 days. That's what went on there. For we were on the end of the pier for I guess 3.5 days mostly before we got clearance to come back. And after that, We took all these people back, about 300 wounded people back to Pearl Harbor. And I had, at that moment when we got to Pearl Harbor, there were orders awaiting for me to report back to the U.S. and get another ship. As you may know, by this time I was a lieutenant, and I was a full, what they call, senior watch officer. So I was a senior deck officer underway on our various watches. And we all had to learn very quickly, as you can imagine. It was very intensive on-the-job training. And the I have to digress a minute. The transport ships were originally manned in the officer category with merchant marine officers. They were a part of the Navy. They were Navy Reserve. And the masters would become lieutenant commanders, and the first mate and second mate, they might be a lieutenant or a lieutenant JG when the war started. And so these guys were our teachers aboard ship.
What does the JG stand for?
Oh, the junior grade lieutenant.
Okay.
Lieutenant junior grade. You have ensign, then lieutenant junior grade, lieutenant, lieutenant commander, and commander, and captain. So the merchant marine officers were wonderful, wonderful sailors, and very, very good to us. New 90-day wonder guys who really didn't know what the heck we were doing, but they taught us, and we, if you kept your mouth shut and followed orders, you got along pretty well. That's what we had to do. Anyway, by 2 years, I was a senior deck officer, running a ship with 600 men.
And when you had your watch detail, what were you doing? You had binoculars? And watching for the approach of planes?
On the main deck, on the in the main the chart house, where the helmsman was. And so we would have our orders of the day and know where we were going and what courses we were steering. The captain was always right behind us. His quarters were just one doorway off the bridge. Mm-hmm. The executive officer was nearby. The navigator was nearby. So the officer of the deck wasn't alone by any chance, but we had to do our work. And then when we were not on the bridge, we had to do our regular divisional work. I had a division of 100 men that took care of all the decks, you know, and the boats and the stuff like that. So it was a lot of working and learning to do. So anyway, after we got back to Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 1943, and I had orders to report home and get a new ship. And the new ship was in New York. So I had a 30-day leave, and I got reacquainted with my wife, who was of 9 months. We were able to go to the UCLA Rose Bowl game on January 1st, 1944, and then I had to depart for New York after. And in New York, there was another transport similar to the one I had before. This was called the Arlington, and I was going to be the damage control officer for that ship as a first assistant to the person who is called a first lieutenant. In the Navy, a title of first lieutenant means he's about the third ranking deck officer following the captain and the executive officer. And the first lieutenant is in charge of all the the hull of the ship and the boats and all the rigging and anchors and everything. Well, the Arlington was not, it was still being converted from some kind of a cargo ship, and it wasn't ready for another 2 or 3 months, and I think it was in May we finally got the sea duty, sea tests and so forth. And by June, we were ready to go. We were sailing up and down the Atlantic. And we got orders to go to Seattle, of all things. And I thought, sure, we were going to Europe, because after all, the mid-1944, everything was going to Europe. But that didn't happen. We were sent back to Seattle to become an APA boat landing training ship. And
APA stands for?
APA?
Yes.
That's attack transport. The P is for personnel.
Okay.
And the A is for attack, which means the boat to go ashore, you know. my wife had been with me in New York for several months, and when we finally took off, she came home to Los Angeles, and when we found we were going to Seattle, she got on the train and joined me in Seattle when we got there. But that little bit of heaven lasted only about 2 weeks, and I had new orders to report back to San Francisco on an emergency basis to take the place of a lieutenant who had broken his leg falling down the stairs at the officers' club. And my new duty was to become first lieutenant of this giant erector set called a floating dry dock. And I had never heard of a floating dry dock up to that moment. What the Navy had done, it was a really an incredible forward-looking feat of engineering. They built these sections of dry docks. They were all self-contained. A section was 200 feet long and 100 feet wide, and they would be towed across the ocean by tugboats and other ships and assembled on the site. And they were assembled, welded together to form a basin for a dry dock. And so,
where ships could be repaired that had been damaged in battle.
So that's what happened. We, 2 days after I got to San Francisco, as the first lieutenant, which is an important officer, aboard a vessel that I had no idea what the heck it was or how it worked. So there I was, and our seven sections were towed across the Pacific for 46 days it took to get to this place called the Admiralty Islands, which is in the Bismarck Archipelago on the equator, more or less, just north of New Guinea. And we got there in at the end of October of 1944. There was already a dock in business there. A 10-section dock was already operating. And so it took us until December 7th to get the dock assembled. the assembly was supervised by the Navy officers called civil engineer, the CEC Corps. The civil engineers were the shipbuilders and dry dock people. When we started docking ships, there was a contingent of Seabees that lived ashore, and the Seabees would come and do all the manual labor, all of the ship fitting, the plumbing, and boilerplate, and whatever was necessary to repair the ships. And then they would go back. They were working six-hour shifts, so they around the clock. So we had every 6 or 7 hours, there'd be a new shift of guys come aboard and repair the whatever was going on. I was the only, except for the captain, on this ship, on my dry dock. He was a regular Navy guy, commander at that time. But none of the other officers had been to sea. They had been with the dry dock for a year or two, and the civil engineer officers were not seagoing people, mostly. So the captain appointed me to be the pilot to bring vessels into the dry dock as needed. So that's what I did. I was the only one that had any ship handling experience. And so on December 7th of... December 7th keeps turning up. Mm-hmm. Of 1944, we docked our first ship, the cruiser, heavy cruiser St. Louis. And I went out in a boat, and I came aboard the St. Louis. Fortunately, the St. Louis wasn't damaged by the war. She only needed minor repairs. And I went aboard the ship and took over. The captain gave me the bridge. And I had a couple of boats that we progressed our way into the dry dock and came to a stop. And that was our first time, and we did it very well. And so the captain gave us a well done. That's important. So anyway, in the next, from December to the end of the war, we were docking ships every few days. Sometimes they'd be in for 3 or 4 days. Sometimes it'd be 1 day. And altogether, we took care of about 100 ships in the 6 or 7 month period before the war came to an end. And that was very important. There were two docks at Guam, and we had two there at Manus Island. So we must have, between the four docks, you may recall that during this time was the invasions of Okinawa and Iwo Jima and all of the kamikazes and so forth. So and the Philippines. The Philippines operation was going on, a lot of damage. So these ships were the dry docks were very, very important in the scheme of things to help get ships back into action rather than coming all the way back to Pearl Harbor or not getting repaired at all. So this was a very important thing.
Sounds like your crew must have been very efficient with all these shifts of getting the ships fixed up really quickly if you were able to return so many of them.
Oh, yeah. We did. We had a very wonderful crew. And the engineering officers were good. If we had a large ship to dock, for example, the engineering officer would go, we would get the ship's hull plan, and we had to set they had to set keel blocks at the on the floor of the dry dock, and the keel blocks were held in place by wires. And so each ship had a different configuration for its keel. And so when we would bring the ship in, and then the engineers would lift the dry dock up by pumping water out, and it would come up under the hull of the ship, under the keel. And then our divers, we had divers, would go down and inspect the connection between the keel and the keel blocks and make sure everything was tight and in place. And then the engineers would bring the ship up out of the water into the dry air. It was a wonderful, marvelous operation. It's just incredible. So that's what we did.
Okay. If we could just pause for a minute, we're going to put another tape in.
Sure.
They run out after a while. Okay, I'm David Noreen. Once again, this is tape two of our interview with Robert Green. We were talking about the dry dock operations that he worked on. Would you like to continue?
All righty. Well, one interesting incident at the dry dock, we were several hundred miles away from any Japanese installation. The nearest one was this place I mentioned before at the top of the Solomon Islands. Now I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, as I say, we were about 200 miles away from that. And one night at midnight, on the dry dock, it was too hot to sleep inside the walls of the dock, which had been made for cruise quarters. The carpenters made kind of a lattice work living quarters on top of the wing wall. That's where and we had all the people lived on top of the dock. So I was at the end. My quarters were at the end of the dock. And I heard this terrible airplane noise at midnight. And I thought one of the Marine pilots is going to crash our dock. We had a Marine airstrip not far away. And it turned out there was a terrible explosion right under my bunk, practically. A Japanese torpedo plane had come over from Rabaul, that's the place. Two planes came over, and they dropped two torpedoes. One hit our dock, and the other hit the other dock. It was on the end of the dock, and the timbers flew up in the air 50 feet high. But the dock was... very, very secure, and nothing really happened. We shook a little bit, and everybody realized what happened, and the two planes, we think, were splashed into the bay not far away from the docks. So it seems kind of weird to have a dry dock that's been torpedoed, but that's what happened to us. I told you this was like a giant erector set. And so the engineers and crewmen detached the section that was damaged. They just cut the bolts apart for the welding and pulled it out. And then we sank down and they docked our own section, put it back in on skids and repaired it. And then reversed the procedure because the dock was still viable and operating, even with six sections, it was perfectly okay. So that was an interesting sideline. I wanted to go back a minute to our action at Tarawa, which, of course, was terribly bloody. And my crewmen were, there were many of my friends, the officers who were the boat people bringing the troops back and forth. But there were a dozen different heroic rescues. One of our sailors, the boat mechanic, swam out 100 yards to get a help to come back to his boat to rescue the guys that were trapped. And other one guy from another ship was the actor. Eddie Albert, who was a Lieutenant JG at that time, and he was a, what they call a salvage boat officer, and he rescued a boatload of 30 Marines that were in danger of being annihilated. So altogether, we had these wonderful people working under fire. And they were, after the battle, the captain, our captain, was allowed to appoint people that win, to win citations and awards. And one of our officers was awarded the Navy Cross, which is fantastically high, next to the Medal of Honor. And 6 months later, when I was aboard the Arlington, I got this package from the Navy that had awarded me the Silver Star for my duties aboard the at the end of the dock with all the other guys. My senior officer, Lieutenant Taylor, had been similarly honored, and several of our other guys, the boat mechanic that rescued the 30 guys was given a Silver Star. And I said, well, I really didn't, you know, it was hard work for 4 days, but all the other guys were doing the same thing. But, you know, the captain gets a single out who gets awards. And I'm very gratified. It was a nice thing to do. The Marines themselves had hundreds of awards. Those boys were just incredible. The way that aboard my ship, the Zylon, we had carried the top command of the 2nd Marine Division, Colonel Shoup, who was given a Medal of Honor, and Lieutenant Hawkins, who was also a Medal of Honor. Colonel Shoup survived and Lieutenant Hawkins didn't. He was a terribly brave young man who was killed on the second day of operations. So anyway.
He was killed while he was taking the troops into the shore.
Lieutenant Hawkins?
Yes.
He had got ashore with his small boatload of boys and was attacking the pillboxes and was injured. He was injured hit three different times. And finally, his shoulder was totally blown away and they couldn't save him because he lost too much blood. So that was a pretty bad thing. So anyway, I was aboard the dry dock until the end of the war. In January of 1945, while the operations in the Philippines were still progressing, my former ship, the Zylon, was involved in the landings at Lingayen Gulf. That ship had a wonderful, marvelous history. They must have been involved in 15 different landings. They were all over the place: Guam, the Australian coast, and finally the Philippines. And they were struck by a kamikaze plane while doing their work at Lingayen Gulf. And this one day in January, we got notice that the Xylan was coming to our dry dock to have some repairs made. Actually, we didn't dock them. They came alongside, and our traveling cranes took off all the damaged superstructure. The kamikaze had smashed into the top of the Xylan superstructure and wiped away a gun position and killed 6 people and injured about 20 more. But there was no damage that would sink the ship. So anyway, they were able to come down, and they pulled alongside my dry dock, and our cranes were able to take away all the damaged goods. And so I got to go aboard and see my my old buddies once again. Most of them were still the same as I had left them a year before.
Were they surprised to see you there?
Rather, yeah, they were. Yeah, they were pretty surprised. It's funny that, you know, the vagaries of life. You never know where it's going to lead you. So that was the war ended in August, as we know, and I got to come home. I stayed aboard for another month or so, waiting for transportation, and so I didn't get home till about November of 1945, and that was the end of our war experience. That's about the size of it. I didn't stay in as a reservist.
Mm-hmm. So you also earned 4 battle stars on your first ship, right?
Yes. My 4 battle stars were for the Guadalcanal operation, the Tarawa, and the 2 Aleutian Island campaigns.
Mm-hmm. Attu and Kiska.
Yes. My ship, the fellows that were aboard, some of the crew, the Navy had a habit of officers were rotated every year or two for whatever reason. But my crewmen on the Xylan, some of them were aboard for the whole 4 years of the war. Came aboard in January in Seattle and took the ship all the way through decommissioning, including a part of the flying, what they call the flying carpet, bringing the boys home from Japan, from the Orient. So that was, the Xylan Association is still in operation. They're just having another reunion in Phoenix. I couldn't go because of other commitments, but they still have 15 or 16 sailors that will come to the reunions, mm-hmm. Along with 30 or 35 family members. Many of the fellows bring their grandchildren. I was with them in Washington, D.C. a couple years ago. So we had a very, very nice reunion. Probably won't have very many more because everybody is over 80 years old now. And we're running out of time.
You mentioned there is a book on that, too, by Robert E. Witter, Attack Transport.
Yes. Robert Witter, he's a writer down south somewhere, And somehow he picked up the story of the Xylem. We were very popular because we got a lot of notice. In our Guadalcanal operation, we had Robert, famous writer, oh dear, my mind. For Time magazine, he was aboard our ship twice. And so with having him aboard the ship, we got extra coverage in Time magazine and others. And so this fellow Witter picked up this all these stories and finally decided to write a book. He contacted our association and 8 or 10 of us who were willing to participate in the study gave him stories and depositions about what was going on. Robert Sherrard was the writer, the journalist that was with us. And that had was twice, once at Tulagi and once at Tarawa. So we got a lot of coverage from him.
You mentioned another book, too, by Colonel Joseph Alexander on Tarawa.
Yes, Colonel Alexander wrote the definitive minute-by-minute story of the Battle of Tarawa. Colonel Alexander is still, he's a well-known writer, and he attends many, many sessions of the Pacific War that goes on down at the Nimitz Museum in Texas. Yes, Colonel Alexander wrote the book. I gave him a few incidents of my involvement. So that was his book is called
Utmost Savagery.
Utmost Savagery, yes, and it's he goes minute by minute through the whole thing with all different threads of Elam. Nobody knows the story, you know. No one person can ever know what's going on. Sometimes 20 feet away. So there's all kinds of different little threads of the stories that have to be told. And he picked them all up and merged them into one book, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, as I say, we after the war, I had one more year of college to do. And we lived on the northwest side of northeast side of Los Angeles. And right next to, we're just one block away from Occidental College. So I walked to school every day. I finished my bachelor degree at Occidental College in Los Angeles. And I went into the insurance business and became a pension plan consultant and administrator. And that's what I did for about 40 years. Finally retired and came here to live. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank
very
you.
Interesting story.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.